Let's go on to our next question, kids. I don't want to depress anyone except myself. I'm good at that. Number 7. Your thoughts on what is horrific must have morphed. What terrifies you today versus what terrified you 10 years ago? Are you braver or more craven nowadays? That is interesting. I guess he's talking about horror, right? Or is he talking about just life? Because when he says, are you braver or more craven, that's not talking about writing. That's talking about life. And so, what scared me 10 years ago versus what scares me now? I feel like I'm totally the same person that I was in 2006. I've got a state of arrested development, and I haven't progressed a solitary day in the last 10 years. But a few years before that, you know, when I first moved to Los Angeles and I was on my own and I had to learn to depend on myself, I know that there was some growth there, some maturity. There were times when I wanted to buy something and I couldn't do it. I knew I shouldn't do it. I had to be responsible. I had to think about the future. And that's totally gone away. I buy worthless stuff that I don't need now. And afterward, I'm like, why would I buy that? Oh my goodness, that's so weird that I would buy that. What would I possibly do with that? Anyhow, what I found horrific then. I recently finished that audiobook that I was mentioning in an earlier recording session. And at the end, I wrote an all-new about the author. You know, about the author. Rich Outfield is a writer, podcaster, and voice actor. And I thought it would be fun to have a paragraph in the about the author where I just listed the things I was afraid of. And a couple of them are bullcrap, like I wrote potato salad. I wrote people that have three thumbs on the list. Although there was a man who had three thumbs that he worked at a gas station in the little town where my story... What was the story where the two girls discovered the dentist's office, that there was mind control going on in the dentist's office? That town had a gas station, and there's this clerk behind the counter, and he had two thumbs on his right hand. And that was so disturbing to me, just really upsetting. How come I can't remember? Was it a dental title? Like open up and say ah? Office visit is what I think it was called. You know, that's not as good as open up and say ah, is it? Ooh, I like that title. Open up. I like this ship. I like that title. That's pretty good. I could maybe change office visit to open up and say ah, or I could come up with a new story with that as the title. You know, start with open up and say ah, and say, okay, I'm coming up with a story that can match, that can fit with this. Anyway, kids, I'm afraid of a lot of stuff, but I'm not like horribly afraid. There's only two or three things that I'm really afraid of. And I talked about, Big and I talked about the idea of an old woman crawling on the floor toward my bed at night as being the most terrifying image my mind can invent. And I don't think that that has changed. There have been times when I've woken up from a bad dream and I open my eyes and there's someone standing at the foot of my bed. And it's never an old woman in like a white nightgown. Thank God. But it's usually a man-shaped form standing at the foot of my bed. And I will kind of hold my breath or, you know, just like process this. But it's happened enough times now that I know that it's my imagination. It's a carryover from my bad dream. It is a shadow. And my brain, because it's halfway between sleep and waking, is saying, oh, that's what that is. That's a man. That's something bad. And usually if I stare at it
for more than a couple of seconds, it becomes my bookshelf, or it just becomes a shadow, or it becomes nothing at all. And I know that there was never anything there to begin with. However, I have talked about my sister having some kind of fear that there was a dude in the house. She and I live in the same house. She's downstairs, I'm upstairs. And my nephew, who was about 7 at the time, saying, yeah, one time I woke up and there was a man in my room and he was by my bed and he was making this face. And he like gritted his teeth together in like a parody of hate. And I was like, oh man, that's effed up. Now, I still don't believe that there's a ghost or a malevolent presence in the house. I'm sorry, I just don't. And I don't believe that that kind of stuff exists anymore. We make up these stories to control others and to explain the mysteries of the universe. But, you know, the many times I have seen that shape and then it goes away, or it doesn't kill me, or it doesn't laugh or speak or anything like that, and it becomes something else, has taught me that if that sort of stuff exists, that people would talk about it all the time. You know, either that stuff exists, and I have been visited by this ghostly presence a dozen times or more in the last decade, or that stuff doesn't exist. And maybe that's a logical fallacy, but I don't care. Superstition is not helpful. And maybe it's great for you. I doubt it, but maybe you find comfort and inspiration and encouragement in superstition. But it doesn't serve any positive purpose for me. It's only negative. There was an earthquake when I first moved to Los Angeles. It was the second earthquake that I experienced. The first earthquake that I experienced was in October, and I was staying with a friend from college on his floor, and the whole building just swayed back and forth, and I heard all of the car alarms starting to go off, and you know, he's like, hey, there you go. You've been here a week, and there's your first earthquake, and it was the biggest earthquake that I experienced in all the time I lived there. But a few months later, there was one that happened, and I was laying on my bed and I was watching Richard Donner's The Omen, which is a fine film, but not particularly scary, except that while I was watching it, my bed started to shake. And yes, my mind immediately went there. A, it's a coincidence that I happen to be watching a scary movie or a devil movie or what have you. But I could have been watching The Little Mermaid. I could have been watching reality shows. I could have been watching porn. And it would have been, you know, so scary that something was shaking the bed. Every once in a while, you know, there is that sort of thing that comes back. I am scared of ghosts. I am scared of children that act like they're not children. And scared of homeless dudes a little bit. There was a movie by John Carpenter. It came out about 87, 88, called Prince of Darkness. And in it, Alice Cooper played a homeless guy. What did we call him before homeless? There's a word. And he was so scary to me. Oh my gosh. My friend Dennis and I used to talk about that all the time, about not knowing that this guy was Alice Cooper, but, you know, he had ratty black hair and circles under his eyes, and he was just a scary dude in that movie. And that's kind of scary to me, is, you know, that sort of thing. I'm almost finished with my story, Newfound Fame. I think it's Newfound Fame. I considered Newfound Celebrity. I considered calling it the Brown Depths. And Lady Gaga had an album called The Fame Monster, and I thought, that's what I'm calling my story. But it seems pretentious. It seems like I'm trying to cash in on a Lady Gaga title, and I'll be damned if I cash in on a Lady Gaga title. So I think it's going to be called Newfound Fame. But in that, there's a monster, a ghost, a demon, a being, a malevolent being, and that's scary to me. Hopefully the story itself is scary. I'm a success if it is. But the idea of something or someone that's not natural marking you, following you, stalking you, and nobody else sees it is really scary to me. And so I was really happy when I came up with that idea. But here we are a month later and I'm still not done with it. And I'm less happy, less pleased with it. Maybe when I do my recording of it, I'll discover that it is a really solid story and I'll be happy to share it with you and anybody else. But right now I'm just like, oh, that's too bad. And here's the thing. I am down on myself as an artist. I am down on myself as a writer. I know I can do better. I always tell you on this show, it's probably not a great story. It's not a great story. I say it a lot. But a lot of times, the idea is a good one. I get these ideas that jump into my head, and they are solid ideas. I've had some ideas that are great, legitimately great ideas, and my weakness is in converting the great idea to a story that is great. And a lot of times, maybe not every time, but a lot of times, I fail in that. Do you remember the story about the guy who got drunk in Las Vegas, and they're at the blackjack table? Was it blackjack? And some woman, who's not a woman, she's a demon of some sort, sits down across from him, and only he can tell that she is a demon. That idea was such a good idea when it jumped into my head at that casino in Nevada. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I want to run to the motel room and start writing this, because in my head it was sharp and solid and scary. And part of it is that his friend is with him, and his friend sees nothing out of the ordinary with this woman. And it marks his friend as its next victim, as its target. And our main character is so drunk, what can he do about it? Something is going to happen to his friend. Now, I remember just being depressed when I did that episode. That was one of the early Rish Outcasts, because it was a really solid idea and it just didn't translate. I couldn't write it as scarily as I wanted to, as effectively as I wanted to. I wanted it to be scary, but also really sad that he knows he can't help his friend because he's drunk and he's helpless and he's worthless. Autobiographical there, right? Maybe I should cut that line too. There have been some things that I've said in this episode where as soon as I say them, I go, ooh. I think I'm going to cut that part out. Because there's truth, and then there's truth. You know what I mean? There is honesty in conveying to you how I feel. And then there's too much, you know, information, as they used to say. Oh, are you braver or more craven nowadays? I've backslid. I had a little bit of bravery. Not a lot, but when I lived in LA, there were a couple of times I tried things that I had never tried before. Like, okay, you know, I'll give this a try. It scares me, but I'm going to give it a try. And now, like, I went to the amusement park, the state amusement park, a few months ago with my friend and my niece and my friend's kid. And there's always been the ride, you know, the ones where you're sort of in a seat with your legs hanging down and it shoots you up into the air. And then you drop straight down, and then you go up, and then you drop. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like a tower, you know, a catapult or a stratosphere or whatever you want to call it. And those have always scared me. I've been on them a couple of times. I went to them at Six Flags Magic Mountain in L.A. And
scared the heck out of me. I didn't enjoy it. And I was there with them, and the kids were going to go on it, and my friend was going to go on it. And I was in line with them. The line was long. It was about a 45-minute line. And I stood in the line with them because I was like, why not? And at the last minute, I was like, why not? Because I'm afraid. I don't like that feeling of falling. I'm not going to do it. I had wasted all that time, and I didn't even go on it. And the me who was once young would be disgusted, I think. The me who wrote a song for a girl that I had fallen in love with and ran home and got the song. When I found out it was her last day, I ran home in the middle of work. I said, you know, to hell with work. And I got that song and I brought it to her and gave it to her. I put myself that on the line. I haven't listened to that song since that day. I recorded it, and I was filled with emotion and stuff, and I had put myself out there for this girl, and of course she didn't like me back. When I think back now, I just wonder why would I even have liked her? But you don't choose who you like, do you? I'm a little bit surprised that I would have done that, that I would put myself on the line, that I would put my nuts on the pool table, as it were, and left myself vulnerable like that. But, you know, it was her last day. I knew I'd never see her again, and maybe that makes things easier. I don't know. I'm afraid of rejection. I'm afraid of criticism. I'm afraid of failure. I'm afraid of opening myself up 100% to someone that can harm me. Because that's the thing, is when you open up yourself, when you lower your defenses, you leave yourself vulnerable to attack. If you always have your guard up, if you always have a stiff upper lip, if you always have your teeth clenched, then, you know, people can't hurt you as badly. And maybe you can't feel as deeply if you're that way. But I think that would be really neat. I'd kind of like to be somebody who nothing bothers. You know, there's been a whole lot of attention on Donald Trump in the last few months. And hopefully that's all a bitter memory for you guys in the future. But he's one of those guys who just doesn't give a crap what people say about him. Except for every once in a while, he does. He's just such a blowhard and such a loudmouth oaf. And part of me, it admires that. That I wish I could be that guy. I think about going back and doing it all again. Going back to elementary school, or going back to junior high, or going back to the first day of high school or whatever, and they say you have to do it again. And how differently I would do things. And, you know, there were a couple of teachers that were assholes. And because I'm a grown man now, I would say, well, what? I would not put up with that. Why do they get to be an asshole? But you got to remember that they're adults and you're kids when you're in that age. And they are allowed to be assholes. And you're not. So, I don't know what would happen if the, middle-aged me went back to being a teenager. Except for that I know that I would not allow bullies to terrorize me, to make me afraid, to break my will. I would end up killing them. And I'd have absolutely no qualms in doing so. But it's hard to explain that to a child psychologist or to a policeman, where you're like, oh, sorry, this is my second time through. And the first time, they made life extremely hard for me. And I was always afraid, always looking over my shoulder, and I felt like a worthless turd. And that followed me for the rest of my life. So you're damn right I killed them. Because if they did that to me, then they undoubtedly did it to others and will continue to do it to others. So in many ways, what I did was a very selfless thing. I did the world a service. I'm pretty sure I would get sent someplace where, you know, they put jackets on backwards. And that would be weird, where you're like, oh, shoot. I came back in time and I know all these things about the future, but now I'm in a mental institution and I can't do anything. I think about time travel a lot. And I really like the idea of going back and doing the thing that I didn't do the first time. And, you know, I've got a couple of friends that have teenage kids. And we talk about how it was to be a teenager and how our teenagehoods were and our upbringing. And pretty much without exception, these fathers always say, you know, sometimes I just like to set my son down and say, you know what? No, you go out and do whatever you want and make mistakes and screw up badly and get your heart broken and try and fail. I know people tell you don't do that. I know people tell you play it safe. I know people tell you, oh, no, no, you've got your whole life ahead of you. Don't be in such a rush to grow up. Maybe I have certain kinds of friends, but they all say, that's total bullshit. Now is the time when you feel the most. Now is the time when you need to learn what life is all about, and you need to find out what happens, and you need to explore your own boundaries and find out what makes you happy. Stop living for others. It's just, I've got a lot of regrets. It sure sounds like, doesn't it? And I would hope that nobody thinks that I blame my parents for my misery. There are other things that I blame. Part of me blames myself. It's a horrible thing, and it needs to be stamped out. And sadly, I have to cut that part out too. But I can't imagine anybody enjoys listening to these episodes. Maybe I'll just save them for myself. It'll be like a journal entry. You know, everybody's afraid of different things. Everybody has their own idea of what is scary and what is harmless, whatever you call it. I like supernatural threats. I like to write about ghosts and curses and doppelgangers and shapeshifters and demons and stuff like that. You know, I've been doing it for a long time, with varying degrees of success and failure. And, you know, I've got two nephews that I live with that weren't born 10 years ago. And so that changes a little bit, you know, what is scary and what's not. You know, the thought of something happening to them does occur to me from time to time. And I took my nephew to a comic convention a year or so ago. Maybe it was 2 years ago. And I lost him. And the police had him. They found him. And there was an announcement. They made an announcement. And I went and collected him. And I, you know, the boy had just been hanging out with the cops. But the crazy thing is, the next Comic-Con that I went to and took him to, I lost him again. And this time I lost him for a lot longer. And because I had lost him the first time, I said, okay, you know, if we get separated, here's where I want you to go. Just go there and stay there. There's like a big Lego display where they had built like a city out of Legos. And I said, that's where I want you to go. And just wait for me. You can look at the Legos, and I will eventually find you there. And I went there, and he wasn't there. And I had my niece, who was there at the time, go to the Lego thing and just sit there, just camp out, waiting for the boy to show up. And he didn't. Finally, I went to the security, and there was a lady there, a middle-aged lady, and I told her the situation, and she's just like, okay, give me his name, and, you know, we'll make an announcement, and, well, I'll tell all of the security guards and stuff to look for him. And you know, this was a convention. Maybe I should have explained. The second one, this one that he got lost in, there were over 100,000 people there. That's a lot of people. And because I had lost him the year before, I wasn't freaking out. I know the kid. He's like me. When I was a kid, I would get distracted. I would look at something, and then my mom would be gone. And I would get lost all the time. All the time. And, you know, probably the first couple of times that I got lost, my mom freaked out. But by the time I was old enough to remember, she was used to it. She just knew that this is what happened. So they paged him, and he didn't come. And she's just like, oh, no, what are we going to do? And I realized that she was getting freaked out. She was more freaked out than I was. And I explained to her that, hey, look, I lost him last year. And he said that he had gone to where I was, and then he just wandered around looking for me. And eventually a policeman saw him walking around by himself and said, hey, are you lost? Come with me. And they went and they did an announcement and they paged me. And she's like, oh, you know, I hope that that's what has happened this time. And she was freaking out, and I felt weird because it made me wonder, well, should I be freaking out? And then you start to think about it, and you start to think about, you know, what does she know that I don't know, or what else could have happened? And that's when you start to become afraid. And finally I said, well, look, I'm going to go to the top of the stairs. They had these bleachers in the center of the hall where you could watch presentations. And I got the idea that if I walked to the very, very top, I was in a vantage point where I could look around and maybe spot him. And she said, you know, in the meantime, I'm going to be here and I'll talk to everybody and we'll have him check in and everybody will look for him and we'll keep paging him. Anyhow, I don't know how long I was up there, a half hour or more. My cousin kept texting me and saying, did you find him? And finally, I looked down and there he was, right there below me. And I shouted, you know, hey, stay right there. And he looked up and stayed. And I walked down. Anyway, the lady heard me shout. And so she was at like the information desk or the security desk. That's what it was. And I went down there and I hugged him. And the lady came up and she was just crying. She hugged him too. And it's like, we were so afraid and scared. Oh, thank goodness we found you. And that freaked him out, that this stranger was visibly upset. And I don't know if it freaked him out in a way of, oh, I'm in trouble, or in a way of, oh, people were really afraid for me. They were really nervous. But I thought that that was really strange that she cried. I don't tend to write about that sort of thing because it's not fun. I like horror stories, but I like them to be fun. And that's probably, you know, why I'll never have a story on this pseudopod. Besides the obvious reason, I like my horror stories to be fun. Something happening to your child or to your spouse, those are scary possibilities. And it's an intimate fear. It's a dread, you know. By this point, you've read Lost and Found. You've read it or you've heard it. And what happens to Elsbeth Vance in that story is not spelled out. But I know what happened to her, and you probably do too. That's awful. You don't want to dwell on that sort of stuff. It's meant to be a relatively fun story about a dark subject. And I wondered about that. I wondered about how much of what she went through I should talk about. And I remember texting Big while I was writing it and saying, shoot, man, I don't know how graphic this should be. I don't know how disturbing this should be.
And I ended up pulling my punches a lot as far as what the boy sees and maybe, you know, even what he is capable of understanding about the situation. So there's a couple of lines in there that hint, but nothing explicit. And you know what? Maybe even that is too much. I would not be surprised if somebody read that and they got to that part and they're just like, oh, this isn't fun anymore. And that's too bad. But in some ways, that's a horror story as well. I don't know. I have a soft spot. I have sympathy for my characters a lot of times, and I don't want to see them suffer. I don't want to see them die. And there have been a couple of horror stories where my intention is to kill the main character or the love interest or the best friend or whatever, and when it comes time to do it, I don't want to do it. I feel bad in doing it, and I have copped out a couple of times and given it a forced happy ending. And I don't know if that's a weakness in my writing. I tend to think that it's a strength because I care about the characters. And also, it's so easy to kill the girl that's running from the serial killer. But what's hard is coming up with a way that she can escape or turn the tables on her attacker in a way that feels realistic or justified or earned. There have been happy endings in movies where it's so unearned that it ruins the movie. The Steven Spielberg War of the Worlds from 2005, I absolutely hate that movie. And a lot of it has to do with that ending. It's a cop-out ending. It's a, you know what? Calling it a cop-out ending is giving it too much credit. It's an absolute betrayal, dishonest, whatever the step above cop-out is. Something that's unforgivable. And I would hate to have written something like that. I would hate to make my reader feel as betrayed as that movie made me feel and makes me feel 11 years later. I've never seen it again since the day it came out. And about 1998, 1999, I came up with this joke that there's an old Spanish proverb that goes, Aún Spielberg hizo Hook, which is basically saying even the great Steven Spielberg made Hook, saying, you know, even the best of us can fail, even the greatest of us can fall. And I did it in Spanish because it's funny if it's an ancient Spanish proverb talking about a movie that came out in 1989 or 90. Maybe it was 91. I don't know when Hook came out. No, Last Crusade came out in 89. Always came out in 90. My guess is 91 was Hook. But that proverb notwithstanding, I like Hook a heck of a lot better than I like the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds. Anyhow, that was me talking about fear, talking about stuff. They say that every 7 years, all of your cells have regenerated, and you're a completely different person than you were 7 years prior. And I don't know if there's any truth to that, but I like the saying, and I like the idea that we are reborn every 7 years, and a veritable new person. And everybody uses it as an excuse to leave their wives. So, 10 years ago, if that theory is true, I was a different person. I don't feel like a different person at all. And, you know, I don't really feel like I have gotten better, considerably better as a writer than I was. How many years ago was 7 years. 2009? Or 10 years ago, as he was asking, which was 2006. I wrote Birth of a Sidekick in 2005. And I thought that that was a solid story. I've written stories before then that you'll never, ever, ever hear that I thought were really solid stories. But I don't know. Maybe that doesn't mean that I'm not getting better. I was a different person in those days. And maybe the things that I wrote about when I was living in LA, the priorities that I had, the worries on my mind, the hopes and fears, and definitely whatever girl I was interested in at the time who had no interest in me, were that all that was different. And so the things that I wrote in those days would be different than the things that I write now. And that is cool. You know what I mean? It's good to change. It's good to go to new places. It's good to be around new people. It's good to come up with new attitudes and new likes and interests and pet peeves and fears and dreams. I hope that I'm getting better as a writer, but I hope that I was good a long time ago. At that writer's symposium that I went to, that I've talked several times about, it was brought up on more than one occasion, you know, that you write a novel, and if it's your very first novel, chances are it's not going to be very good. One of the panelists said, you need to give yourself permission to suck. And, you know, that might be really freeing to a lot of people. That might be the kind of advice that they need to hear. But boy, I didn't like hearing that. I don't want to open my mind up to the possibility that Into the Furnace sucks. Because the amount of time that I spent on it, for me at least, was considerable. And if the book sucks, holy cow, then all that was wasted time. Then, you know, what if I never write another book and that's the one that I wrote and it sucks? I mean, then what's it all for? I understand that they're saying that as you continue to practice, as you continue to write books, you will get better. You will learn what works and what doesn't work. And maybe your efficiency becomes better, etc., etc. But I just don't like the idea that everybody's first book sucks. I don't think it sucks, mine. But the thought that me in like 2021 could open that and be like, ugh, that's really bothersome. I don't like the me in 2021 if he thinks that what I wrote in 2015 is bad. Maybe that should be a fear of mine, that I wrote something and that it sucks. Yeah, see, I keep talking along these lines. I'm never going to put that book out. And that helps who? Just the ghost of Hitler. That's really the only person that's thrilled with that scenario. Number 8. What is the ideal Rish? For example, if Rish lived at optimal levels, would he own an island, publish every year a bestseller, and be married to a Brazilian model? Or would he live a different life? I feel I've sort of already answered this. What did he call me? Did he say the perfect Rish? Is that what he said? Or what did he say optimal? The ideal, that's what he said. The ideal Rish has a family. He has a wife that loves him. He has kids that sprang from his loins. He works hard at a job that is at least somewhat fulfilling. And the ideal Rish maybe thinks about writing from time to time, but he's got other things on his mind, better things on his mind. Good for that ideal Rish. I don't know that he's married to a Brazilian supermodel. Let's say that there are infinite alternate realities out there. I'd say that there are several alternate realities where I died, several alternate realities where I actually became a successful screenwriter. And good for him. I like that reality. There are
realities where that girl that I was so hot for in high school, who I actually thought about yesterday in a embarrassingly affectionate way. Oh my gosh, man. Mental illness. There is an alternate universe in which she liked him back and they got together. And they'd certainly not be together anymore in 2016 because she was a terrible person. And you know what? Maybe 17-year-old Rish Outfield was a terrible person too. I don't know. He was a weak person. He was a callow person. But I felt like he was inherently decent and that he tried to do what was right and he failed a hell of a lot of times and he was hard on himself. But the fact that he made it through being 17 says something. I don't imagine that there is a single alternate universe in which I am married to a Brazilian supermodel. Oh, you know what? There is one. Shoot, I had to look through. I realized if I sorted them in a different way, then they would come up. And the way that I sorted it was world population. There are a couple of worlds where there's no population at all, and that's sad. But there was one where there was a population of 873 million people. And so all the billions that we have on our world, something happened to them. And in that alternate reality, I am married to a Brazilian supermodel. I can't remember what her name is. Is Miranda Kerr Brazilian? I know there's like an Alexandra Ambrosio or something like that who is a Brazilian. I don't think either of them are my spouse in that universe. I only glimpsed it for a second. But in that universe, oh my gosh, there's so few fertile males left. And I happen to be one of them. And so, in that world, I'm a catch. And, you know, the sad thing is, I talked to him for just a minute. And he was doing all right. But there was a sadness, an underlying sadness to him. And I said, well, what is it, dude? I saw the way that she let you touch her. And he said, but she wouldn't. If this were your world, she wouldn't have anything to do with me. And then we were both depressed. So see, that was a weird question that you asked, the whole Brazilian supermodel thing, sir. But I digress. I'm good at digressing, aren't I? I wonder, is there a podcast out there called But I Digress? Because if there isn't, oh, wow, it's a better title than the Rish Outcast. Almost a better title than the podcast that dares not speak its name. But I digress. Whew, good stuff. Question number 9. Can you change for the better? If so, how will you change? Obviously, you produce more work, so that is good. But is that a character change or merely a change in habit? Huh. Well, that's a good question. As I may have stated, I've been writing every single day for the last few weeks. Today marks 3 weeks plus 3 days, which is 24 days, right? In a row. I've written every single day for 24 days. Now, some days I've written 200, 300 words. Some days I've written 1,200, 1,500 words. There were a couple of days where it was probably over 2,000 words. That's nowhere near professional. That's nowhere near where I need to be if writing is my job. You know what I mean? And at that symposium, they pounded it in. Hey, you need to think of writing as a job, not as your hobby, not as something you do in your spare time, not in something that you do when you feel like it, but you need to do it every single day like you're clocking in for work. And I haven't been doing that. I've been doing it as a way, you know, like exercise. Like, hey, I got to exercise every single day or I'm going to get flabby. So I'm partway in between. I do it when I want to and I do it like a job. But yeah, that's just a change in habit. And they've said before, that if you do something for X number of days in a row, it becomes a habit. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, because I have written for a month before or longer. I know Big has too. That doesn't mean it's a habit. Habit is something that you can't help. Drinking, murdering, eating the flesh of children, which is delicious. I got some honey mustard and... Anyway, can you change for the better? That was the beginning of the question. Yes, I can. Will I change for the better? No, probably not. It takes a special kind of person to rise to the top. There were a lot of really talented writers that were in the audiences or on the panels, and almost every single one of them had a day job. Almost every single one of them worked full time or had a spouse that worked full time. So I guess what I'm saying is very, very few of them made enough money off of their art, their writing, that was their bread and butter. That was their main form of income. Now, I consider my audio work to go hand in hand with my writing. I try to do a little bit of audio editing every single day. And I know I haven't been as good with that as I have been with my writing for the last month. But sometimes I'll sit for an hour and do audio editing. And it's rare that I sit for an hour and do writing, just because that's harder. That's not harder. It's just... they're two different things. They may fill a creative niche in me, which is great. But one of them, eventually people will listen to. You know what I mean? Whether it's a podcast or whether it's a audiobook for someone else or an audio production of my own work. There are venues for that. And the writing, there are venues for that as well, but I don't see it the same way. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I put out a That Gets My Goat episode today, 100 people will have listened to it by Friday, or 1,000 people will have listened to it by year's end or something, you know? And that was probably an exaggeration. I doubt 1,000 people listen to That Gets My Goat, though they should. But if I write a story, then I have to do another draft, and then I have to maybe do a final draft and cover art and formatting and publishing it. There it is. But that doesn't mean that 10 people will buy it, or 100 people will buy it, or even one person will buy it. I would rather waste my time writing a second story than the amount of time that it takes to publish a short story. In the time since I started recording this, this has been about a 2-week process. Just every time I get in the car, I answer a question. And sometimes it takes a couple of recording sessions to answer a question. But in that time, I finished the production for that story, Lost and Found, which I think I've mentioned a few times. And today, right before I got in the car, I published it on Amazon.com. It's out there if you want to scoop it up. And by the time you hear this, the audio version will be out there if you want to scoop that up. And, you know, it's a headache, all of the formatting and uploading. The audio thing, I have to upload the title and upload a 5-minute sample and upload all of the chapters and upload a end credits, you know, where this has been, Lost and Found, written by Rish Outfield, and the copyright information. I also did an author's note on it. I did a about the author. And that's a lot of work. But now that it's out there, right? So in 2017... that's next year. Sorry, I was trying to come up with some science fiction year that so far in the future we'll all have alien DNA in us. We'll all have animal DNA in us and be planning our trips to
Saturn's moons for vacation. So let me rephrase. Sorry, in the year 2027, that file should still be there. And somebody could still buy it and read it, listen to it. So that's, I guess, what I was getting at is, you know, it takes some time to do that. But once it's out there, it's out there. And that's good. I haven't changed much. I'm still the same really sad person that I was then. I talked about my teacher at college who said that, you know, I was a good writer. I said I should put my stuff out there. I loved hearing that, but I don't think I've progressed much since that day. There was a writer who submitted stuff to the Doonstief a few times, and we ran his stuff, not everything that he sent, but, you know, he was just one of those in the circle. You know, somebody like Josh Roseman or somebody like Jason Sanford, who was a friend of the show. I considered him a friend of the show, and every time he sent something, if we liked it, we would run it on the show. And we ran a story by him, and it got, I'm not going to say it got a negative response. It got a mixed response. Some people really liked it, some people didn't. But he never sent us anything again after that. And I know that, well, I don't know, But I imagine it was because people said some mean stuff. That's too bad. I'm like that, definitely. Somebody on a different podcast, not an enemy podcast, but another podcast that's out there, asked me, they actually, I think, emailed and said, do you have a story that you want to run? I've read some of your stuff, and I think it would be a good fit for our show. And so I sent him a story, and he didn't run it on the show. It wasn't what they were looking for. And, of course, I never sent him anything again, ever. I would never send him anything again. Who's the crazy one here? No, obviously I'm the crazy one here. Where he invited me to send something and then rejected the first thing that I sent. But, you know, to be a real artist, to be a real creative person, you have to have a thicker skin than that. Every single person who's ever been successful in anything has had people that think that they're overrated, people that think that they're talentless. They've had enemies, in fact, that want to destroy them. And I think that's probably a necessity for anyone who is creative to have a thick enough skin where they can withstand these negative people out there, these people that dislike their stuff or people that are jealous because they feel like the stuff that has been published is not as good as maybe their stuff, or they, you know, are jealous, think there might be some nepotism or a lucky break on this person's behalf. And then, you know, there's always the group that just enjoys hurting others. The trolls, as they called them back in the day. And it's a shame that I don't have, you know, some armadillo skin that I can just put on and say, hey, people are going to dislike the things that I do because people dislike, there are people that dislike everything. That's how the internet works. And I need to just keep going. Can you change? Can Rish Outfield change? That was part of his question. I would have changed by now if I was going to change. I guess that's what I'm saying. I hate to make it sound like I'm dismissing your question, despite having talked for 6, 7, 8 minutes about it so far. I'm not dismissing the question, but the answer is no. I can't change. That's too bad. You know what I mean? Jeff and I had this interesting conversation the other day where we were talking about racism and we were talking about whether the world is getting better or the world is getting worse. And I said, you know, what would happen if you and I had been transported back in time? 1,000 years or something, or, you know, 500 years, what would happen? Would we rise to the top because of our education, because the world that we came from, because of our understanding of science and mathematics and biology and you know, history, things like that? Or would we be branded as heretics, witches, and burned at the stake and murdered because, you know, we speak English and they speak Latin or whatever they speak wherever we go 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? And Jeff said, well, it could be either one of those things, but more likely you and I just aren't equipped to live back then, to live by the sweat of our brows, to live, to come up with a way to make money and provide for ourselves. You know, the 21st century has made us weak. And he said, you know, if there was some kind of skill that you and I had that we could apply to that time period, then maybe we would just die because of whatever diseases were in the air there and that we had no immunities for. And because we're so dependent on the medicine of today, the things that protect us from getting sick, we'd be toast. And I thought about that, and I thought, wow, in a place where we're plunked down and we're forced to evolve or die, Jeff thinks we would die. And, you know, I think so too. He's right. We talk about the apocalypse, you know, the day when technology fails or nuclear winter comes, you know, an asteroid hits, some kind of terrible disaster or plague or whatever, and only the strong survive. There's very, very little chance that I would be one of those survivors. I'm not clever enough. I'm not self-sufficient enough. I'm not strong enough to survive in a Mad Max world, to survive in a Terminator world. And I don't know if that's terrible. I mean, maybe you wouldn't survive either. Well, this has all been pretty sad, hasn't it? Knowing that we're both going to die in some kind of apocalypse. Let me end on a positive note. Jeff and I were having this conversation, and he talked about that every time he talks to somebody, they talk about how much worse the world is getting, how the world gets more corrupt, violence goes up, poverty goes up. It just gets worse and worse. And he said, yes, that's what leaders want you to believe. That's what the Republican Party wants you to believe. That's what religion wants you to believe. But if you look at the statistics, things are actually getting better. You know, the people who would have died of diseases just a few short years ago may have a chance now. And crime is going down if you look at the numbers. And even if, you know, our children are fatter than we were and lazier than we were, and it seems like, you know, their options are more limited than ours were. I mean, if you look at the magic of the modern world and the things that we take for granted that are just so amazing, and that just within my lifetime, if you were a musician, you could just record a song yourself in your room with a microphone and your guitar, and millions of people could hear that song. You could become famous for doing nothing, like Big was telling me about the heroes of his daughter, who are people who play Minecraft on YouTube, or who get on there and they talk about Shopkins, or they talk about, I don't know. I realize these are dated references because I don't know what has replaced Minecraft and Shopkins in the minds or hearts of youth. But these are not people that have accomplished anything, and yet they are famous and they are action figures of them, and they are rich. And so I guess what I was saying is, just in my lifetime, I can make money selling the things that I write if I had been born a few years later and self-publishing had existed when I was in high school. Those stories that I wrote and that I shared with Matt Lloyd and I shared with Dennis and I shared with Rhett and shared with, you know, just a very few, a handful of people, I could have put them out there. And hopefully I would have been smart enough to do it under a pseudonym. And I don't know how life would be different if that were the case. Big was telling me about how lucky I am, Rish Outfield, because I'm better off than somebody who came along who doesn't have a following, who doesn't have a bunch of people who know who he is because of a podcast, who might be inclined to buy something with his name on it. And that was weird. It was weird to hear Big say that we were lucky about something. But he's right, you know. We've had this podcast for a number of years, and there's not a lot of people that listen to it, but the ones that do listen to it and like it, really like it, and they like us. And yeah, we do a good job with people's stories, and I think we run really good stories. I mean, of course I think that, because I choose most of the stories that get run, you know. Every once in a while there's a stinker on there where I just go, ugh, dang, voters upvoted this story, or, you know, because of politics we ran it, or because Big really liked it. But most of the time it's me, or my hands are on it. So yes, I think we run these good stories, but come on. Escape Pod, they run, like, you know, the best of the bunch. They pay a fortune to their writers. They can afford to do so and to have, like, these famous writers or these people that are big deals. And if you want a really good science fiction story, my guess is you would go to either Escape Pod or Starship Sofa. You wouldn't think of us. But if you want what we do, which is talk and try and make you laugh and try and have something nice to say about every single story that comes on the show, and we come from a point of humility or whatever a step below humility is, and personality, and we want the listeners to believe, to feel that they are our friends. And that, I know we've succeeded in. Because I get emails, not all the time, but I get them, of people who feel the way I hoped they would feel when we did the Dune Stephen. Big was saying, you know, that these same people would buy something that has my name on it. Would buy something that has his name on it. I don't know why it's always me. I guess every single thing that I've said negative about myself could apply to Big Anklevich and then some. But, you know, there's nothing I can do to change him. And as I said just a minute ago, there's nothing I can do to change me either. But this is me. This is my show. This is me we're talking about. We're pointing one of those really industrial strength flashlights on me, where you see all the faults and all the fears and all the insecurities. The last question on this thing is, what victories does Rish envision in the next 10 years? And see, Tom was smart to put a positive question at the very end. An open-ended positive question. Because, yeah, I've said some negative stuff, and I apologize if people have turned it off, then, you know, fuck you. Because you don't hear me apologize. But if you've sort of soldiered through thinking, wow, this is some dark stuff, this guy needs some counseling, this is the positive spin at the very end. What victories do I foresee in the next 10 years? Well, I'm writing every single day. And I'm going to take a few days this summer where my intention is to write. I'm going to go either to the cabin or I'm going to go somewhere. And I'm going to write and probably record, do a little podcasting. So if you like my stuff, there is more coming. I'm going to keep trying to put out audio versions of my work. Now, on this show, you're going to get some of them. For stuff like Lost and Found or Into the Furnace, I probably won't run it on the show. Although it sure would be easy when, you know, I've got something that's got 10 chapters. You know, it would be easy to do like 2 chapters
an episode and go for 5 weeks and put it out there that way. I just don't know that I will. I want people to buy something. And, you know, I found from Birth of a Sidekick that people were willing to buy something that they had already gotten for free. Same thing with The Calling, although with The Calling, at least, you know, there were some changes to it. If you bought a copy of The Calling in 2014 or 13, whenever I put it out, I caught a couple of typos in it. There are a couple of sentences that I didn't like. So you feel free to contact me and I will send you an updated version for free. I'm going to keep doing this. And I Into the Furnace is not the only novel I'm going to write. I said somewhere, either on my blog or in a podcast, that I wrote 2 novels in 2015. And it turns out that wasn't entirely the case. I typed up the second Birth of a Sidekick, which I had meant to write as like a novella, about the same length as the first one. But my intentions changed while I was writing it, and it got really big, and I ultimately felt like it was a novel, but when I typed it up, it was only 30,000 words long, or fewer, I don't know, it was something like that, which is still a novella. But in looking at Into the Furnace, as I've been trying to finish that thing up, just in doing a last draft, I tend to add so much to those. With Into the Furnace, I think there'll be a 7 or 8,000 word difference between what was, you know, typed up and what ends up in the audiobook. And if that same thing happens with the second Birth of a Sidekick, which I still don't have a title for, what I wanted was something of a sidekick for every single title. And Big says, you know, hey, Death of a Sidekick, when's that coming out? And yeah, he's right. That's the final installment, right? But I was thinking Challenge of a Sidekick, Growth of a Sidekick, Journey of a Sidekick. But what I really wanted was to use the phrase, the term, the word second chance. But I didn't like second chance of a sidekick. It just was unwieldy. And so I thought, well, a sidekick's second chance. And it's all right, but it's not a great title. That's what I wanted. And at this point, it's probably going to be a sidekick's challenge. Yeah, it's just a shame that I couldn't find something that meant second chance, but didn't sound... Second chances for a sidekick. Yeah, it doesn't sound right. And maybe sidekick is the problem. It's an archaic word. Nobody really uses it anymore. We use it in comic books, in discussions about comic books. It's probably not even really used anymore in comic books because it became a negative. It had negative connotation, probably due to the goddamn Adam West Batman show. That and Frederick Wortham are the 2 worst things to ever happen to comic books. But it may be when I finish a sidekick's challenge, if that's what I call it, and put it out there, it will have expanded enough to where it will also be a novel. And so that's cool. And plus, I want to write more of those. There was a 10-year gap between Birth of a Sidekick 1 and 2. But I sure don't want there to be that long of a gap in between 2 and 3. I laid a couple of seeds in that story for a follow-up. And in fact, just the other day I thought about, oh, you know, I could write a short story that takes place in between the 2. And I started sort of jotting down what I wanted to happen in it, and basically nothing happens. And I thought, oh, well, okay, I won't do that. But there's more to be told with Ben Parks before we get to Death of a Sidekick. And I really enjoy writing those things. If I could make some money and get some people who are excited to read the adventures of Ben, they look forward to it and they encourage me and they buy it, then why couldn't I put out one of these every year or every other year? If I were a real writer, somebody who made money from writing,
That would definitely be one of my projects, one of my priorities is, okay, you know, every year I'm going to put out another one of these, and it wouldn't be too hard. It shouldn't be. Anyhow, I'm out of space on this recorder. I've gone all the way to where there's no more space. Isn't that crazy? But I want to thank you for listening to all of this. Three episodes now? And I want to thank Tom Tancredi for continuing to support me. He's a good guy. And these questions, even if maybe I didn't answer them great, made me think. And it's neat that somebody cares about what the answers are. And so I thank you for that. I appreciate there are people that listen to Rish Outcasts. And I will try and be back with one with a story next time.
Good night.
For your information, the podcast you have just suffered through was produced under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives 3.0 license. That little bit of knowledge just might save your life one day.
But again, if you enjoy my work, let me know. If you have questions for me, let me know. If you have things that